fireworks. When I was a kid, you could get all kinds of fireworks. And every 4th of July, the dads of the neighborhood would bring home all manner of munitions to be launched to the sound of these space shot countdowns and stand back, kids. But those days are over. Those fireworks are mostly illegal. But last summer, I tried to reclaim those days of real liberty when the stiff, cold hand of the American government hadn't squeezed the life out of the simple joys of fireworks and American freedom. I went to this store in Idaho, a fireworks heaven just off the interstate. And I'm telling you, it was...
Does this story have a happy ending?
Well, not really. Nobody gets hurt, but I'll tell you, I almost lost my wife. It's true. Happy fireworks 4th of July. It's the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning and happy Independence Day. It's Friday, July 4th, and hopefully my co-host, well, hopefully he won't blow up anything, at least in telling this story this morning. But we're going to take a look at the weakening U.S. economy, a trade dispute in Argentina that could threaten the government, what this holiday means to people from a variety of perspectives, and flights from Taiwan to Beijing. Do they land at the domestic or international terminal? It's an issue for diplomats and heads of state. That and all the news. A first in 60 years in Taiwan today, a direct flight from China landed with tourists in a sign of warming relations between the two countries. Taiwan spokesman Liang Chang says they're thrilled the Chinese will finally get to see Taiwan.
This is a landmark decision. They can get to know what's going on, really, in Taiwan.
Taiwan and China have been ruled separately since 1949. The French have a big welcome in store for newly freed hostage Ingrid Betancourt. The former Colombian presidential candidate, also a citizen of France, will arrive outside Paris today. She spent 6 years in captivity by leftist rebels. In Colombia, Defense Minister Juan Manuel Santos says her release is a serious blow to the rebels' FARC.
I just think that in the end, this certainly shows that this is the beginning of the end of the FARC.
Three American contractors were also freed and have been reunited with their families.
After insisting for months that 2,200 Marines serving in Afghanistan would come home on time, the Defense Department has extended their combat tour by 30 days. The 24th Marine Expeditionary Unit will come home in early November. In Zimbabwe, about 200 people, including women and children, are camped outside the American embassy seeking political asylum. They say they've been attacked by supporters of Robert Mugabe.
In California, more than 350 wildfires are still blazing. The one bearing down on Big Sur has destroyed 20 homes. A fire north of Santa Barbara is threatening nearly 1,000 homes. After months of speculation, the White House says President Bush will attend the opening ceremony at the Olympics in Beijing next month.
And oil closed a little over $145 a barrel, but we're not thinking about that this morning. We're thinking about this holiday and the meaning of it.
What is the meaning of July 4th for you? Is it about independence? Is it about enjoying a day off from work? How do you feel about this July 4th?
Or are you a little more strident like the colonists were in 1776 when they wrote a document that sort of put it to the man there in London? Who do you want to put it to? If you have an idea about the meaning of this holiday or who you want to declare your independence from, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or write us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody, and happy Independence Day. American markets are closed on the 4th of July, but the sense of unease about the U.S. economy is still with us. Yesterday, the Labor Department said that employers cut payrolls by 62,000 in June. That's the sixth straight month of nationwide declines. The jobless rate held steady at 5.5%, though. The bigger story is that the trend seems to be persistent. Declining employment in the U.S. economy, stalling out in various sectors. What does it mean? Is there a cumulative effect of the drastically reduced confidence, it seems, in the U.S. economy? Louis Uchitel is a New York Times reporter who covers the U.S. economy. Louis, is there a sort of crisis of confidence when you look at all the individual statistics? I mean, the one that stands out to me is General Motors stock taking such a dive, hitting a 54-year low.
Well, there is an issue of high oil prices, rising cost of getting around, which, of course, affects General Motors. But there's a broader issue of a weakening economy, weakened partly by the energy crisis, but also by stagnant wages, which are, as the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported yesterday, not for the vast majority, for the vast number of ordinary workers, workers below the rank of management, they've been going up slightly, but inflation has been going up much faster. So purchasing power is being destroyed, and that, in effect, affects consumption. Consumption affects what companies do, and companies start layoffs. Now, so far, this has been happening rather slowly. There's been job cuts every month for the last 6 months, but they've been at around 100,000 over the last 3 months, and between 90 and 110,000. Not big numbers, but it's chipping away at the economy. And as we chip, and it seems to suggest that in the months ahead, those layoffs will get larger as companies try to adjust to less and less income.
Of course, in the media, you know, we like to evaluate these stories on the basis of each individual chip, but maybe the broader story is the more important one, and that the economy does seem to be slowly stalling out in virtually every sector. I mean, I suppose unless you're an oil company executive, there's not much good to look forward to, and it doesn't seem like there's any sort of sector that leads us out of this stall out that seems to be happening. Would you agree?
No, at the moment there isn't. Yesterday, the only sectors that went up were health care and leisure activities, which means restaurants and hotels. Those are usually low-wage sectors, and as the Bureau of Labor Statistics explained to me, the job growth in those sectors is way below the pace of a year ago.
And those are recessionary indicators, at least if you look culturally. People seek entertainment in times of economic woe. And, of course, healthcare issues, do manifest themselves when economic stresses occur.
Yes, that's all true. But so far, the economy seems to be growing at a very small pace, 1% or so. And there's always the possibility that these numbers will be revised. However much we are not in a recession, that is technically not in a recession, technically not in an economy that's contracting, it certainly feels like a recession when people's purchasing power, wages aren't going up enough for them to maintain their purchasing power, particularly at a time of rising energy costs. So we're going into the election with the mood of the country, and it's measured by confidence surveys, rather bleak.
Do you think this mood is going to have more of a political effect, and this is my last question, or is it going to have bigger economic effects between now and the end of the year?
Well, I think the mood will be a result of a will stay bad. It will be the result of a deteriorating economy. And I suppose at some point, even more than today, the candidates are going to have to address very seriously what to do about it. They are sort of addressing it now, but more in general, campaign terms than in real political terms. The next question will probably be what sort of a government stimulus package should follow the one that's now expiring, that is the tax rebate checks.
Stimulus package number two, the sequel to the original. Louis Uchitel, thanks so much for joining us. Louis Uchitel is a reporter for the New York Times.
I had this vivid image as I was listening to him of being nibbled to death by ducks. It's not one particular thing that's rocking the economy. It's all of these seemingly small things, and it's just hard to know when it's going to end. But right now, We're going to stop talking about it, and we're going to talk tennis. We're talking tennis on this holiday, July 4th, and not asking whether you'll be playing today, but we're taking a look at the big headlines out of Wimbledon. Once again, Venus and Serena Williams will battle it out for the championship tomorrow. Today, the men's semifinal will determine who is going to be playing in the men's final on Sunday, with Roger Federer playing today and hoping to defend his title. Joining us now is Judy Dalton, who knows all about the high stakes of Wimbledon finals. She lost to Billie Jean King there in 1968, and today she's a BBC commentator. Judy Dalton, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's an all-Williams sisters final. Was it a smooth ride for them to get to the big game?
Yes, it was, but I think it was a smoother ride for Venus yesterday against Elena Dementieva than it was for Serena against Zhang Ji. Zhang Ji played unbelievable tennis, and I think Serena was really stunned by it, but she was certainly stunned in a way where she played unbelievable tennis to get out of situations that could have been very tricky for her.
They are an extraordinary two women. They've played each other 9 times, I think, in major tournaments, and Serena leaves 5-4. But is she ready this week for Venus's 127-mile-per-hour serves that she was dishing out this week? I believe that was a record.
It was a record, and yes, I think she is. I picked Serena from the very first day because I think that on grass she is the better player, I think. Of the two of them, if you had to, make a choice, I think that Serena is the better player. She's better than Venus. She is able to get out of so many situations with that wonderful serve. She doesn't serve as fast as Venus, but I think it's a much more reliable one.
I interviewed the sisters once a few years ago when they were at Wimbledon, and I asked them if they had a theme song, what would it be? And Serena immediately said Wonder Woman, and Venus gave her a big elbow and said, no, just the two of us. It was a real big sister, little sister dynamic. And do we ever see any of that playing out in the court?
Well, not in singles, but in doubles they certainly do. But Venus is certainly the one who looks after Serena. Serena gets away with a lot, because she's the youngest sister. I mean, she's the youngest of the five of them, and Venus certainly does look after her, but she won't be looking after her in the final, I can assure you. And I think that that the two of them really both want it tomorrow, and I hope, for everybody's sake, that it's going to be a really good match.
Is it good for women's tennis to have the Williams sisters headlining yet again? The last time was in 2003 when they were in the Wimbledon final.
Well, if they're good enough, that's the way it is. If the other girls can't beat them, why should they object to them being there and being headlined?
What's been the response to the two of them ending up in the final tomorrow?
I think people are saying, oh dear, the Williams again. But then the real tennis people say, well, they deserve to be there and that's it. And I think everybody's just hoping that it'll be a really good match.
How has tennis, women's tennis, changed, you think, since the days when you were playing?
There's more money. much more money. The whole sort of aspect of it, that they have trainers and coaches and psychologists and everybody, they have a huge support team. Whereas when we played, we only had ourselves and we had to just do everything for ourselves.
Pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. Let's
That's
not
exactly
forget
right.
The men. Today there are two games, Roger Federer versus Marat Safin and mm-hmm. Rafael Nadal, who's coming off a French Open win, versus Rainer Schüttler. What's your thought here? What should we be looking for?
I think the first match, Federer against Safin, will be the better match of the two. But it really depends on Safin. If he comes out and he decides that he really wants to play, then I think he will challenge Federer. But I can't see Federer losing, but it might be, quite a good match. The other one...
Some good match, I think, is happening behind you because we can hear all that clapping.
Yes, they've only just started. They've only played 3 games.
Sounds like you're going to get hit by a ball there if you're not careful.
No, don't worry. It's fine. Federer is leading 2-1. That's it. So don't worry about it. It's very early stages. And the other match, Nadal and Schüttler. I mean, Schüttler played this long, long match last night, the second longest match in men's history, and he didn't finish till very late. And Nadal has had a day's rest. And so I think that it'll be a walk in the park for Nadal. I hate to say it, but it's interesting because last year Nadal had such a tough time to the final.
He sure did.
And this year he's had really an absolute walk in the park.
We'll have to leave it there, Judy Dalton.
That's fine.
Thank you very much. Judy Dalton, BBC commentator.
At Wimbledon.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. So today, well, it's July 4th. It's a holiday. What does July 4th mean to you, John?
Well, you know, today it means hopping on a train and going up to see my family and thinking about all of the things we have to be thankful for America-wise. It doesn't mean fireworks. It usually does, but fireworks have gotten so weak that I don't even use them anymore.
No more fireworks for you? For some people, there are going to be some fireworks today.
That's true.
For other people, like our contributor Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor at Essence Magazine, well, he's in New Orleans for a little music. He says there are multiple meanings for the 4th of July. This festival he's at is sponsored by his magazine. Good morning, Patrick. You're in New Orleans right now. What does New Orleans symbolize to you on this 4th of July?
Well, New Orleans, for me, at least for the past 14 years, has symbolized, you know, our festival, which, you know, celebrates African-American culture, which is not celebrated on the 4th of July at all. We didn't find, which is one of the reasons that we decided to do this, the huge festival, which draws about 200,000 people who opt not to have hot dogs on the 4th of July, but alligator on a stick.
Alligator on a stick?
Yum.
Yeah.
But isn't there, given that New Orleans is still recovering from the aftermath of Katrina, is there some cultural meaning to being there on this day that we celebrate independence in America?
Well, New Orleans has always held a special place in the African-American community. It's been, you know, long had, you know, all of our cultural traditions here, from music and the blues to food to the enslavement. You know, you can always trace all of those elements of who we are as a people to New Orleans, more so than any other city.
Let's talk about the July 4th for the Negro, the speech by former slave Frederick Douglass. Let's listen to a bit of it spoken by James Earl Jones.
This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony.
That was a speech that Frederick Douglass made 160 years ago. And Patrick, in your estimation, is there a dilemma for African Americans in observing July 4th?
There is. And I wanted to also point out that Frederick Douglass pointedly mentioned New Orleans in that speech because at that time it had the most horrific of the slave markets. And so when he was talking about enslavement, he was addressing what was happening in the New Orleans slave market. African Americans have always felt ambivalent about the 4th of July. You know, we are quite patriotic. You know, I'm sure you, Adora, can relate to this. When we're in school, you know, as kids, we love, you know, putting our hands over our hearts and saying the Pledge of Allegiance. It's only until we learn that we're Black. We first think of ourselves as Americans until we learn that we're Black. And then once we learn that we're Black, not from our own culture, there are all these, you know, meanings that have nothing to do with who we are or what we see in our homes and in our lives. And that's one of the things we've been doing for years, for generations on the 4th of July, celebrating family and family traditions instead of going to, you know, the town square where there's, you know, picnic baskets and fireworks and, you know, singing of the Star Spangled Banner. We've been, you know, doing the electric slide in our backyard during our family reunions, having ribs and potato salad.
You know, for lots of people, that's
John, you did that as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. But you know, having grown up in lots of diverse communities around the United States, you know, my dad worked for IBM and dragged me all over the country. I mean, it's striking that over time, as well as over space and across ethnicity, the meaning of the 4th of July is varied and has evolved. And I think in some ways that may be unprecedented when you think about Independence Day celebrated in other national groups. You know, we're really a moving target here in the United States on the 4th of July.
Exactly. And John, I don't know if you guys know about Juneteenth. You know,
absolutely.
On June 19th, 1865, a Union general, I think Gordon Granger, rode into Galveston, Texas, and announced that there had been this Emancipation Proclamation thing 2.5 years later, and 250,000 Texas slaves didn't know. I mean, no one told them. You know, talk about delayed response, right? Or delayed delivery.
3 weeks ago, yeah, it's, I mean, it's still celebrated today. 3 weeks ago, a lady in my building at the Unitarian Church was taking picnic supplies down to her church to celebrate Juneteenth with the whole Unitarian community in Brooklyn Heights.
Right, with the strawberry soda and the barbecue,
yeah,
you know, people dress up because, you know, slaves, you know, weren't allowed to dress up or to, you know, show various colors because of the slave codes. And so Juneteenth really was our Independence Day. And what we try to do with this festival is to take a lot of those elements of Juneteenth, which, you know, of course, you know, parties and, you know, it's very festive, but also to address serious issues as well.
Right, because it is more than just headliners like Mary J. Blige. There are a series of forums that you hold on the state of Black America, right?
Exactly. So tomorrow we'll hear from, you know, Bill Cosby and Alvin Poussant. We'll hear from Ray Nagin. you know, we'll hear from Bishop T.D. Jakes. We'll hear from Tom Joyner. We'll hear from Maxine Waters. This is the 4th of July weekend, guys. And so we're hearing about the state of Black America and failing schools and AIDS in our community because we're not getting those issues anywhere else. Certainly during the 4th of July, no one is talking about the issues that we feel are specific to our community.
A lot going on in New Orleans this weekend. Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor of Essence, we're going to ask you to hang with us for a minute because right now we're going to turn to Femi Oke for the latest news headlines at this hour.
Hello there. It is coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. The Pentagon says that 2,200 Marines serving in Afghanistan will have to stay another month. An explosion at Belarus's Independence Day concert puts 50 people in hospital. The FDA has alerted growers in Mexico that starting Monday, inspectors will stop and examine ingredients common in salsa. They're still searching for the cause of a recent salmonella outbreak. Barack Obama says his upcoming trip to Iraq will refine but not alter his plan to withdraw troops if he's elected.
I will bring our troops out at a pace of 1 to 2 brigades per month. And at that pace, we will have our combat troops out in 16 months.
On the final leg of his Latin American tour, John McCain promoted his positions on immigration and praised an initiative to help stem the flow of illegal drugs into the United States. Ethiopian troops have killed at least 70 Islamist insurgents in central Somalia this week. Ethiopian troops have faced constant insurgent attacks since they moved into Somalia in support of the transitional federal government in the late 2006. Now, just days after closing a plant in St. Louis, Chrysler Corporation has struck a deal today with China's Great Wall Motor Company. Chrysler's exploring opportunities to expand the company's involvement in the development of China's auto industry. And you've just heard it here on The Takeaway. Venus and Serena Williams have 6 Wimbledon titles between them, and it will reach 7. Maybe. The Williams sister will face off on the 3rd time at Wimbledon tomorrow. Their father, Richard, is their coach, and he says, I've heard him say this so many times, and I quote, I can't stand to watch them play. It makes me nervous.
Do you have a preference? Are you a Venus or a Serena?
I love them both. I'm just in awe.
They're so extraordinary.
No, Serena.
Have you ever seen them play? The power is just,
I love their physique,
incredible up close.
Serena, all the way for me.
Really?
And what about the men's? Nadal? I'm Nadal Serena.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. So you holiday revelers, take a moment and ask yourselves, how many passports do you have? We were just talking with Patrick Henry Bass down in New Orleans about the evolving identity of July 4th, depending on who you are in the United States. Well, there's another evolution going on. It's actually more of a revolution of multiple citizenships. People don't have single passports anymore. And joining us to talk about the multiple citizenships proliferating around the world is Martin Flaherty, who is the Leitner Family Professor of International Human Rights at Fordham Law School. He's here with us in the studio. Thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Peter Spiro, who's the author of Beyond Citizenship, American Identity After Globalization. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
And where are you this morning, Peter?
I'm in Rome.
You're in Rome. All right. So which passport are you using today, Peter?
Well, I only have an American passport at the moment, but I'm eligible for German citizenship, and I'm going to get it.
Why do you think more and more Americans are taking advantage of the potential for dual citizenship, or more and more immigrants are retaining their passport of origin in their experience in the United States, Peter?
I think that there are two reasons. One is there's sort of a why not factor. There's really no downside. There are very few obligations that attach to citizenship now. At the same time, that there is some upside. There's some benefits here for travel, for relocation, for employment opportunities, education opportunities. Here in Rome, museum admission prices are lower for EU citizens. And so if I had another citizenship, if I had an EU citizenship, I'd be paying less to get into the museums. And so at the same time that there are no downsides to it, there's some benefits.
And so it's less, Peter, of an identity and more of a credential. Let me ask Martin here in the studio. Do you think the notion of citizenship is declining in significance and something else is replacing it?
Yeah, I think it's becoming more multi-layered. So I think people are claiming allegiances to as many kind of entities as they can. I think of myself as an American, as a New Yorker, but also as an Irish citizen, too.
And you had an occasion to take advantage of your Irish passport just recently.
Yeah, I just got back the other day from Seoul, South Korea, where I'd been teaching this past month, and there are all sorts of riots and demonstrations against the importation of American beef.
We've been reporting on them, yes.
And indeed, people think that it causes mad cow disease. And at one instance, I was able to sort of wave my Irish passport and say, I'm not an American, I'm an Irishman, put on a brogue, and say, don't get mad at me, it's not my beef.
You know, the use of multiple passports and multiple citizenship identities often is a way of bobbing and weaving around controversial political issues that relate to America's place in the world. Peter, do you see that manifested in the behavior of people with dual citizenship, in your view?
Well, you get cases like the one that Martin just described. In the old world, you'd want to have another citizenship in case you had a terrorist attack or a hijacking or something. I think that's actually a pretty small factor in the motivation for securing dual citizenship. I think another big another part of this is to cement an identity. So that if somebody feels a real attachment to another country, usually through parentage or ancestry, that this is a way of showing that it matters to them.
So if you were to get German citizenship, you would be doing it for what reason?
Well, in my case, it would really be instrumental. The reason I'm eligible is because my father was a German Jewish refugee. And I don't really have a German identity. It would really be to get the reduced admissions fees. And it's interesting, there are quite a number of Israelis who are now acquiring German citizenship, even though they have no real love for Germany, but really instrumentally by way of getting European citizenship.
Patrick Henry Bass, are you eligible for Irish citizenship there with your Irish name?
No, but after being in this humidity, I'm trying to embrace my inner Eskimo.
Your inner Eskimo. What do you think the multiple credential of citizenship means in a broader sense of kind of the many identities that we all carry in the United States?
I think that it does point to a dilution of the meaning of citizenship, that exclusive relationships, and citizenship certainly was once an exclusive relationship, tend to be stronger ones. And to the extent that we can all, or many of us, can have multiple citizenships it just tends to be a less jealous institution.
Let me ask a practical question, though, Peter, to my colleague Martin here in the studio. Who recognizes dual citizenship? Where is it practical? Where is it not practical?
Well, it depends. Certain countries don't allow it. Certain countries do. So I made sure that when I got my or claimed my Irish citizenship, that the United States allowed that with regard to Ireland. You know, in terms of practicalities, you know, as Peter said, there is a slight upside. It's not substantial. I get to go through the EU line at airports. And looking to the future, my hope is that one of my daughters, and my wife is Chinese-American, so they're Chinese-looking, but that one of my daughters who figure skates, if she can't make the U.S. Olympic team, will one day skate for that Olympic powerhouse, the Republic of Ireland.
On his way to the Olympics, Martin Flaherty, thank you very much for being in the studio with us. Martin is the Leitner Family Professor of International Human Rights at Fordham Law School. And Peter Sturgo, thank you, too. He's the author of Beyond Citizenship, American Identity After Globalization. Thank you for joining us from Rome. And Patrick Henry Bass getting back to the festival there in New Orleans. Patrick, thanks for being with us.
Now we have headlines from Femi Oke. Femi?
Hello there. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the hour, Ingrid Betancourt, the Colombian politician rescued from leftist guerrillas, is expected to arrive in France in just a matter of hours. The Pentagon says that 2,200 Marines in Afghanistan will have to stay a month longer than promised. And Zambia's president is alive after false reports yesterday he had died in a Paris hospital. Now, it's been exactly a week since the presidential runoff election in Zimbabwe. President Mugabe ran unopposed after his opponent dropped out, citing election-related violence. Now, hundreds who supported the opposition leader, including women and children, are camped outside the US embassy in Harare, seeking asylum. Now, earlier this morning, I spoke to a journalist working undercover in Zimbabwe. She told me how conditions had changed in just the last couple of days.
A lot of people have been displaced from their homes. People have had their, especially those that belong to the opposition party, have had their homes burnt, livestock and their fields as well burnt because of the politics. People are looking for ways out, either trying to run away to neighboring countries, fleeing to neighboring countries, mainly Botswana and South Africa. And these countries have started sealing off their borders now because they too cannot deal with the amount of human traffic.
And some of the people camped outside of the U.S. embassy in Harare have been moved to refugee camps, and aid groups are helping them with food and the conditions there. More than 300 wildfires burning in California. It's a slight improvement, actually, from just a few days ago when 1,500 fires were burning. The two big wildfires at the moment firefighters are focusing on are threatening homes near Big Sur and in Santa Barbara County. And, of course, there's a sporting event that Jay, who's our sports editor, remind me about. The Coney Island Hot Dog Championship.
Oh, of course.
They have now a reduced time to slam down as many hot dogs as possible, happening in a couple of hours' time. 10 minutes to eat as many hot dogs as possible. Joey Chestnut is the US champion at the moment.
Why'd they reduce the time?
I don't know.
Safety?
So that they don't gross out people watching on TV, perhaps.
Right, could be it. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
So the 4th of July is about noisy fireworks, brass bands, and loud parades. But perhaps the best commemoration of American identity and independence happens in quiet little ceremonies all over the country. As immigrants who have studied and passed a civics test, they've been fingerprinted by the government, and they've paid $675 to take the oath of U.S. citizenship. Here in New York, the ceremony happens every Friday morning at 9 o'clock at the Pearl Street Courthouse, right here in New York, as these newly anointed citizens filed out of the courthouse. We asked them what citizenship meant to them and noticed a common theme that seemed a little deeper than news debates over immigration and the political campaign.
It's having the right to vote. I think it's a very important election year, and that's why I'm really happy that it happened.
Well, the opportunity to be able to vote, this is one of the most important, you know, that we can participate in this process. And also, you know, the facility that give you to bring your family from overseas to this country.
It means just having a lot of opportunities, being able to work wherever I want, and just being able to be like anybody else here, having all the rights everyone has and being able to vote.
To get that right to vote, according to the U.S. Census and Immigration Services, you have to be of good moral character, which is determined through a series of interviews. And currently, to become naturalized in this country, there are a whole series of tests, written and oral. San Mateo remembers his test.
How many stars has our flag and how many stripes? So who was the first president of the United States? And how many amendments had the Constitution?
Immigrants recognize bureaucracy and maybe a bit of symbolism in these tests, but they understand them.
Are they practical? No, but I think they provide you with a basis. I mean, if you're going to be a citizen, you should understand what the laws and what the Constitution means.
In 2007, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services received a significant increase in naturalization applications, so they now conduct their interviews and training on Saturdays, Sundays, and after business hours during the week. But the door to American citizenship really opened a very long time ago, and the rituals of becoming an American have been shaped by the ebbs and flows of immigration itself. The Ellis Island Immigration Museum is symbolic of all the various stories of coming to America.
It was the process of buying a ticket to places with unpronounceable names like Pittsburgh, Hamtramck, and Keokuk. But those were details. The island had passed them through. The door to America had opened.
It's Gene Hackman narrating a documentary that plays at the museum. As ships lined with hopeful immigrants crossed the Atlantic and headed to New York, the promise was, of course, freedom.
It was as if God's great promise had been fulfilled.
I've gone into a free land. I don't think I ever can explain that feeling that I had that time.
Those are sentiments that echo straight down to the president, just the present. Just last month, William Wilberforce from Ghana took his oath. His reasons for becoming a citizen are as clear and upright as the Statue of Liberty itself.
It means being part of liberty, being part of freedom, being part of the land of the bravest, being part America, being the face of the world.
Being part of the face of the world, America's world face. That's part of what we celebrate this 4th of July. And you can see the faces of the people we spoke to at the Pearl Street Courthouse, leaving, just having gotten their citizenship, having taken their oath, if you go to our website, mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Today on this July 4th in the United States, we're celebrating Independence Day. But in China and Taiwan, they are celebrating airplanes. For the first time in 60 years, a plane flying from mainland China directly to Taipei landed carrying 600 Chinese tourists, a 90-minute flight that could signal a warming between the two countries that for decades have bickered bitterly. The BBC's Caroline Gluck joins us from Taipei. Welcome, Caroline. There certainly was a lot of pomp and circumstance around those flights today. Tell us about it.
Yeah, there's a lot of excitement, as you said. People are very happy that they can now fly direct between the two places. Up until now, people have had to travel via a third destination. That's normally meant Macau or Hong Kong. And that whole process can literally take the whole day when, you know, a simple direct flight would take, as you said, an hour and a half, and obviously much more costly. Now, and just on weekends, people from the two sides can travel directly to a number of cities in China and in Taiwan. So a lot of excitement about that. People are going to obviously save a lot of money. Businesses are very happy because it's easier for them to have one day commuting between the two places. And the big prize, I think, for many Taiwanese is the expectation that the trickle of Chinese tourists will soon become a flood, because later this month, China has said it will allow up to 3,000 of its citizens to visit Taiwan every day. And Chinese companies are hoping that that will provide a huge economic economic boost. They're predicting that for every 25 visitors, there could be one new job created in Taiwan.
Wow, one new job for every 25. Is this flight symbolic or is it truly substantive? And certainly from an economic standpoint, it sounds substantive for Taiwan.
It's substantive in some ways, although it's not daily. It's only limited to flights going in and out from Friday to Monday. Certainly the government here would like to see regular daily flights. It also doesn't include cargo flights between the two sides, and that's something that Taiwanese airlines really want to see because they do a lot of business on the cargo front. And I think for a lot of them, having expansion into China would really be a big help. They're feeling the economic pinch as globally the global economy is having all kinds of problems with oil prices. But I think it is substantive because it signals a warming of ties between the two sides ever since Taiwan's new president, Ma Ying-jeou, was elected and took office in May. He has said he wants to see better ties with China, particularly on the economic front. He wants to put sensitive political issues on the back burner and focus on very practical steps that could bring the sides more closely together and bring about more interaction as well. I think a lot of the problems have been over the years that governments are talking to each other through microphones and megaphones rather than having any exchanges, opportunities for the two sides to sit down together. So this really is part of an ongoing process of rapprochement between the two sides. But I think we're going to see a lot of similarly historic events happening in the coming months and years.
Carolyn Gluck, A Turning of the Tide in Taipei. Thank you.
Thank you.
Carolyn Gluck is a BBC correspondent.
So when people look at fireworks, they probably don't think of environmental policy, and they probably don't imagine that there's a way to change fireworks to make them more environmentally friendly. Certainly when the rocket's red glare goes off above your city, you're not thinking about the pollution that those pyrotechnics cause. But Michael Hiskey does. He's a chemical engineer, co-owner of DMD Systems, which is a manufacturer and distributor of so-called green pyrotechnics. He joins us from Los Alamos, New Mexico, a place known for popping off a few pyrotechnics on its own. Michael Hiskey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
So what is the design issue or chemistry issue in a so-called green pyrotechnic?
Well, it all revolves around nitrocellulose, which is the chemical that's used in smokeless propellants. And it burns extremely cleanly with very, very little smoke. And it also burns with just a plain old kind of an orangey flame. And so we use the various metals that are required to color that flame, but we use them in a much lesser amount than normal.
So what environmental benefit do we get? I mean, what contaminant doesn't go into the environment for the use of your green pyrotechnics, and what advantages do they have over maybe some other kinds of traditional pyrotechnics?
Well, two things. Number one, on all of our outdoor fireworks, we use no perchlorate. Perchlorate is a salt of recent interest in that it has some human toxicity issues.
So you get rid of perchlorate, right?
Yep, we get rid of perchlorate.
And some of your fireworks can actually be used indoors? They're so safe?
Yes, sir. We use, in fact, that's the major portion of our business is theatrical pyrotechnics or indoor fireworks. And in that case, you know, in the indoor effects, you want to reduce the smoke drastically. Usually smoke detracts from the show.
I see. So the smoke, which is the principal contaminant, detracts from the show. Less of that, more light, more color. And we're talking about indoor, maybe in like athletic domes, not necessarily people's living rooms, right?
For the most part, yes.
For the most part, yes.
We can make effects that you can actually shoot in your home if you want.
Sure. I talk to you off air about actually arranging to get some of those shipped to me quickly?
Only if you're an ATF license holder, sir.
All right. Well, my application is in the mail. Michael Hiskey, thanks for joining us. He's a chemical engineer, co-owner of DMD Systems, a manufacturer and distributor of green pyrotechnics.
You're welcome. Thank you, sir.
Thanks. Fireworks. Oh, man. I learned all about how you don't mess with fireworks laws last year. You know, I was telling you before, I really miss the days when the dads in my neighborhood, Binghamton, New York, would bring these crazy fireworks home every 4th of July. There were no laws. There were no legal issues. They'd light them all off in the backyard. We had mini grenades. We had mortars,
it
seemed like.
That sounds dangerous.
It was very crazy. But I miss those days. The fireworks we have now are like Nerf fireworks. But last year, driving through the state of Idaho, I decided to revisit my childhood, and I saw just off the interstate this huge Walmart-looking building that said Fat City Fireworks, and the sign said Next Exit. I was with my wife. We were headed home to New York the next morning early. I said, I'll get some stuff for the kids. And Allison was a little skeptical, but she went along. And inside this place, man, there was everything. All the old bombs and rockets and zingers and sparklers and these high-tech tantalizing munitions, boxes and boxes. Wow! I'm filling a basket with, like, atomic blasters and rainbow fireballs. The names were great. Allison kind of shakes her head. She says, aren't these illegal? I look up impatiently. Well, they're legal here, honey. I mean, Idaho's a part of the United States, I believe. Right, Allison says, but... And then this rather large woman who's behind the counter at Fat City pipes in with, all I know is you can't drive them across the state line into Oregon. Allison still looks skeptical, but I'm looking at the lady behind the counter as though she's like the Sandra Day O'Connor of fireworks law. See, honey, we just can't take them into Oregon. But we're flying, Allison says. Yeah, we just can't put them in our carry-on bags, I say. And looking at Sandra Day for an opinion, oh, no, you can't take them in carry-on. No. So we spend about $250, two bags of stuff out of Fat City Fireworks. In the hotel, I pack this green hard suitcase full of blasters and rockets. And the next day, we check in at the Boise airport. No problem. There's this little sign at security of what you don't pack in your bags. And guess what? No pictures of atomic blasters and bottle rockets, just flammable fluids and firearms. I'm not carrying those, so we're fine. We get on the plane. It's kind of full. It's kind of packed. I use a wheelchair, so I get seated, and the airline takes my chair and puts it in baggage, so I'm not really moving anywhere. We doze off there in the seats, waiting for the plane to take off, and a flight attendant comes to us and says, Allison Hockenberry, are you Allison Hockenberry? Flight attendant looks pretty serious. I mean, really serious. You have to come with us, ma'am. Your bag. Why? It's your bag. You need to talk to Homeland Security. The color drains from Allison's face.
This
and
is
they
not
literally
good.
No, they take her away. I say, is she going to make the plane? I doubt it, says the flight attendants. You have fireworks in your bag. You can't do that. But the lady at the place where I bought them said, you went to Fat City, right? She knew the whole story. Happens all the time, she said. Allison gets back with seconds to spare and sits down next to me, and boy, is she fuming. They interrogated me, she said. They knew all about Fat City and the story about driving over the border to Oregon. What did they do, I asked. They said there'd be an investigation and we're going to get a big fine. And the fireworks? They took those, honey. They took them. I kind of figured the Homeland Security guys had a party that night, but
well,
I don't know.
Let me ask you something. What lesson did you learn from that incident?
Oh, just leave your childhood behind, I think.
I got one for you.
Yeah.
How about you are a lucky man
that
Allison did
true.
Not get taken
yeah,
away?
That
because
is true.
I suspect she wouldn't have been very happy with you, and that would have been bad.
Yeah, we would have had to mount a helicopter raid, like to free those guys with the FARC.
We want you to keep your responses coming to anything you heard on today's show. Send us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or thetakeaway.org.
You can see a picture of me at Fat City Fireworks on our website later today on a slideshow of the people getting their citizenship, all kinds of stuff. And, of course, have a happy Independence Day.
Oh, absolutely. And while you're vacationing, check us out on iTunes and Facebook.
It's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.